Good morning. You are listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'm Janine, and this is Get the Funk Out. If you have never heard of my show, which typically airs on Mondays, but that's now the best of show, Mondays at 9, you can visit the show blog, which is getthefunkoutshow.kuci.org. I hope your week is off to a great start. I'm really excited to have joining me right now is Professor Susan Charles. She's Professor of Psychological Science and Professor of Nursing Science and Associate Dean of Academic Programs in the School of Social Ecology. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So I was telling you, I found this press release about a new study that you had done. And before we dive into that, I was wondering, Professor Charles, if you could tell me a little bit about your role at UCI and how long you've been here.
Yes, I've been here since 2000, so quite a while, and I am first a professor of psychological science in the Department of Psychological Science. I am also the associate dean of graduate and undergraduate programs in the School of Social Ecology.
Were you originally from California or somewhere else?
Yes, I actually grew up east, outside of San Diego.
Okay.
Like the riverside of San Diego.
Got it. Well, I'm so excited to have you on. I've had the dean of the School of Social Ecology, the dean of the School of Education, and when I heard about your study, which is growing old and being old, emotional well-being across adulthood, I thought it also sounded really relevant to perhaps how people have been feeling over the past 4 years in the pandemic.
You know, it's really interesting about the pandemic because, as we know, the pandemic really affected the health and was much more threatening to the health of older adults, and
yes,
mortality rates, morbidity rates certainly tell us that it was much harder the older you were.
Yeah.
Emotionally, the mental health of people, actually, it was hardest on the younger adults.
Mm-hmm.
The younger you were more affected. In the studies we look at, when we look at people from age 18 to as old as we can get.
Yeah.
So older people are pretty robust and have high levels of well-being, which oftentimes people are kind of surprised by. But usually we see well-being peaking around early 60s.
Okay. So people are better equipped to handle the ups and downs of life a little bit better, like they have more skills to handle the stress?
Yeah, it's a good question. We think there's a combination of reasons. Why is it that as we grow older and we do face losses, I mean, we have physical losses, we see physical declines, we see cognitive declines.
Mm-hmm.
In the 1920s, everyone thought that our emotional well-being would peak in our 20s, at the time that our cognition and our physical health was peaking. So kind of surprised everyone that the older we got, the less negative we became.
Interesting. Okay.
And one strong reason we think it has to do with our perspective in life, and it's our time perspective. So everyone has this either conscious or unconscious idea of how much time they have left in life.
Mm-hmm.
And as you get older, you realize that time is growing shorter, and kind of in the vernacular, we kind of quote, don't sweat the small stuff.
Yes.
As much. So you realize what's important. This is a theory called socio-emotional selectivity theory I've been working with and on for over two decades. And as older people feel that time is growing is running out, they
mm-hmm.
prioritize positive experiences and seek emotional meaning more than other types of goals.
Interesting. I have found in the work I do outside of the station that purpose and meaning is great for any age, especially college students that are still, even though they're back in person, they're feeling disconnected socially and really having some trauma from the past 4 years.
No, absolutely, yes. We see that purpose in life and meaning is really important. We see the change. We see the reasons for purpose in life and meaning change with age. So
mm-hmm.
for older people, it really focuses on social relationships. Social relationships are important for everyone in every walk of life. But for younger people, it often focuses on their life goals. What am I going to do? What's my future going to look like? How am I going to plan for that future?
Mm-hmm.
And COVID was really disruptive for all of that. And so that's one of the reasons why we think it was so much harder especially the formation of social relationships that really occur, especially in young adulthood.
Yes.
At that time, it was very disruptive for all their goals and all their reasons for social meaning and purpose.
A lot of students have been sharing with me that, as I said, even though they're back in person, they feel uncomfortable. They feel that they got used to being isolated, and now being back in person, it feels kind of socially awkward and hard to make friends, and they have anxiety. Do you have any advice?
Yeah, first of all, I can say yes. I get it. I understand, and what they're feeling is what we would expect people to be feeling. That humans don't like change, and when we get used to a new norm, whether it's good or bad, sometimes we don't want it to change, even if it is good or bad, which is kind of frightening sometimes. But when you're used to being alone and not being looked at and not being watched or not being, you know, observed, then being put in a situation where there's a lot of social evaluation, which is can always be threatening, but that's kind of scary, and it's going to take a little getting used to. And I guess the best thing I can say is, yeah, it is going to be hard, and it's going to take some getting used to, but then it will become the new norm, as it was, you know, a couple of years before before the pandemic, and then it'll feel more natural.
I agree. I mentioned to you, I have this business, and I have interns with the School of Sociology and the Field Study Program. Dimitri Zuckerman, shout out if he's listening. He's amazing. I think he was part of your program, wasn't he?
He was actually my graduate student, so I feel very warm feelings towards Dimitri.
Yeah. He is outstanding. So what I wanted to share is a little thing we did for students to give them a little boost of positivity. We went and I got some flowers. Originally I was buying them, and then I had them donated. And then we would put notes of positivity on the flowers, and we would stand on Ring Road. The students would sometimes hold a big foam core board and say, you know, take a flower to boost your day or make your day, and there'd be a little note on it. We ran out of flowers immediately. We did this for weeks. And then at one point, there were some students, well, not some, hundreds lined up to pet the puppies. So we were like, what a great opportunity for an audience. And so we got the flowers and we were distributing them. And it was very interesting because they were happy to get them. But if we approached the students on Ring Road, they would kind of, you know, no, it's okay. You know, they didn't know if there was a catch to giving them a flower. But what I wanted to share is that there was one student who came up to me and she was crying. And I said, I'm so sorry, we ran out of flowers. She says, no, I just want to thank you because you really see us and I'm really going through it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just that small act of doing something kind for someone. You don't know how you're going to change their day or change their trajectory.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's beautiful. That I love that idea of giving them flowers. And I would also just, the psychologist in me, I would love the idea if the next time you did that, if you said, these are flowers, I want you to take a flower and give it to somebody.
Yes.
And see, and just see, like, do they run out as fast? Like, it'd be fascinating because we also know that doing something like that also makes them very happy and form that connection, social connection that we need so desperately in our lives.
Yes. It's so funny you say this because lately, I've been doing some events, and what I do at the very end is I hand out post-it notes, and I say, okay, I want you to write a note of kindness to someone in the room you don't know, and when you're done, I'm going to give you a flower, and it's not for you. It's for you to give it to someone else with the note and the flower, and by the end, if we have enough flowers, everyone will get a flower and a note, but they end up making friends and chatting and smiling and laughing, and it is amazing.
Oh, what a wonderful opportunity you give to these people. That's great.
It's really great. So have you focused on any new research during the pandemic that you'd like to share as it relates to stress or health and sleep?
Yes, we're doing a lot of different research right now. Stress, health, and sleep.
Sleep and stress.
What I became kind of fascinated by during the pandemic was just the, we all know the environment's really important to us. Mm-hmm. And so as far as healthy aging, I was interested in how the environment provides and kind of scaffolds our cognition. So the environment provides reminders. The environment provides a basic organizational structure for our life that we use and sometimes we need, especially if we're experiencing cognitive decline, for example. And if you ever heard during the pandemic people saying, I don't remember what day it is.
Oh, yes, all the time.
That's kind of what I'm talking about. And so I became interested in how our environment affects our cognition.
Mm-hmm.
And we have data from over 30 years on cognition and longitudinal data. So I didn't look at people during the cognition. We did a couple studies of people in the cognition during COVID, but these studies were looking at this with longitudinal data, so it wasn't COVID specific, and we were looking at how engaging activities really help your brain and keep your brain active in adulthood.
Yes.
And it's not just how active you are, because a lot of people have looked at that and found that, you know, the more active you are, the better it is for your cognitive and your mental health.
Sure.
But it was actually engaging in diverse, a lot of different types of activities. So you kind of keep your brain guessing, right?
Yes.
You do one thing, and then you do another, then you move to another activity. And so the more different types of activities you do, we found it's been related to your levels of depression, mortality levels, even when we can adjust for all other types of, like, health, like premorbid health and health behaviors.
Yes.
And so I've been interested in the activities people engage in, and then I was interested in other aspects of the environment, but it kept on drawing me back to for purpose in life and meaning, which is so important for happiness and life. It really is your social environment. And so we're writing a grant right now really looking at the kind of sense of social belonging and that social reciprocity you're talking about, that connection with people, like giving people roses. Like,
yes.
It's a form of social connection, and looking at the importance of social connection for our well-being, cognitive and our physical well-being.
Definitely. I even noticed in my own family, I have a stepmom, and we relocated her to a different state to be closer to family. And she's with other people in assisted living. And she went from living alone to being able to see people, and she's completely changed for the better.
Because
she has that connection. And I didn't share with you earlier, but I was fortunate to get a fellowship during the pandemic, and it was with the AgeBoom Academy. I don't know if you've heard of it. It's with Columbia Journalism and the School of Public Health. And we looked at the power of intergenerational relationships. We looked at, as you said earlier, the situation where in the pandemic, retirees were pushed to safety. You know, we want to keep them safe from COVID, but what happens is they get depressed and isolated,
yes.
and their health
yes.
fails. You know?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting to now we're studying the kind of the fallout of COVID of not just like long COVID and the physical effects,
yeah.
But yeah, the mental health effects and,
yes.
and what it did to keep, you know, to keep people apart,
yes.
and how that affected their health and well-being.
Yeah.
It's really interesting.
So tell us a little bit about your classes for students that are listening that perhaps are just starting out in the program.
Because I started the associate dean position this year, mm-hmm. I'm only teaching graduate students right now, and I teach courses on emotion. Probably next year I'll be teaching still associate dean, but I'll be teaching undergraduate students. And the classes I enjoy most are classes on emotion. And so I've also taught introductory psychology, because I kind of like to get people excited about the field and the practical importance and what you can do with a psychology major, because
yes.
a lot of people just think it's to counsel people, and it's so much more than that.
That's so interesting. I was going to say, teaching people about emotional regulation, that's something I feel like I wish I had learned when I was younger. Does it also focus on reacting, like overreacting, or just taking a pause if something triggers you?
Well, that's great. It's like I planted that question for you, because we've done studies looking at how people react to events in their daily lives.
Okay.
So we're not talking about huge events like a loss of a job or a divorce. So we're just talking about an argument with a friend,
okay.
or a problem at work. And we look at their levels of reactivity. So how much more, how does their emotions change mm-hmm. when these things happen? And we find that the more reactive people are, the more likely they are to have an effect of like a depression or anxiety disorder 10 years later.
Okay.
The more likely they are to have physical health problems 10 years later. It predicts mortality among really older people. It just, greater reactivity is very bad for the health, both mentally and physically. It's interesting, because when we think about health, like what we can do for our health, you know, we think of lists like brush our teeth, definitely sleep, and I have a lot to say about sleep, but definitely you try to get at least seven hours of sleep if you're the average person. 7 to 9 hours of sleep
okay.
is pretty average. Eat a healthy diet, but very few people add on that list, like, see friends, because we know that social support is as predictive of physical health as So like, if you're lonely, it's equivalent to smoking 15 cigarettes a day. So it's as strong as cholesterol levels in predicting physical health outcomes. So social, so seeing friends should be a health behavior, and dealing with just even the mild stressors in your life and thinking about how you react to those stressors is a daily health behavior that people really need to understand, that that handling these stressors and thinking about ways to handle the stressors is really valuable. And as people get older, it's not that that they're often better able to deal with a problem. Mm-hmm. It's what the kind of power with aging is, that what we see is that people tend to get better at understanding what will bother them and not engaging in that,
yes,
or being able to avoid it if they, when they can.
Yeah. Or as my therapist calls it, boundaries.
Yeah, right, right. Just, yeah. And they do it all the time, even when they're not noticing. It's like, well, if you're talking to someone who has a very different political belief, for example,
yes,
maybe you're just not going to talk about politics.
Exactly.
Or if someone says something that really upsets you, it's like, well, do I really need to
engage,
to try to change that person's mind?
Yeah.
You know, it's these things. And because social arguments are the most common stressor that people of any age experience,
mm-hmm,
it's generally these, often not really important for, you know, the future of your career or your life. It's just these more minor conversations that older people are better able to navigate.
Yes. I wanted to ask you this question. How do you think we can be better to ourselves and to one another?
Yeah. That's a great question. What I see in, and it's interesting, in the last couple of decades in clinical psychology, I was trained as a clinical psychologist, so it, what I see more and more is mindfulness and acceptance. And I think, and I think a lot of the undergrads are really aware of this too, which is wonderful, because I don't think this would have been the same, you know, even 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, with acceptance and really kind of understanding and accepting who people are, who you are, mm-hmm, without judgment. And so that, I think, is really something that we need to work on as a country and give each other a break. And sometimes when people are really, especially hard on themselves.
Oh, yes.
What I tell students when I'm teaching an intro or I'm teaching emotions is, you know, you can think, well, I'm not only hurting myself because I'm really being hard on myself.
Mm-hmm.
But we've seen, like, this, not research I've done, but other people have done this incredible research, finding that when you get in a relationship, especially like a partnership, like the person that you're going to spend the rest of your life with, or children,
okay,
the same parts of your brain that light up when you think about yourself they are also activated when you think about that person or you see a picture of that person.
Yes.
Because those people become so embedded in who you are. And so if you're hard on yourself, chances are you might be also hard on those people without even intending to or just thinking, because that's, mm-hmm, that's how you treat yourself. So treating yourself is actually going to help your relationships and the people you love later.
That's great advice. Because if you're good to yourself, you can be good to your people.
Yeah, it's kind of like, for example, like early parents who say, like, you know, they're with their, like new parents who are with their child all the time and say, it's important, I need to be a, like, I'm a working mom, I don't want to go and spend 1 second away from my child because I'm at work, and that's, it's bad enough to be alone, you know, to be without the child. But
yeah,
if they take no time for themselves, they're actually hurting both of themselves. They're hurting themselves and they're hurting that child. You know, that child needs the mom when the mom's happy. You know, one day a week when they're with their friends or calling somebody or just taking that half an hour to work out, you know, mm-hmm, even though it's away from the child, it's helping them both.
It's a recharge.
It's a recharge, and everyone needs that. Everyone needs to take care of themselves.
I agree, definitely. And we've been through so much the past 4 years, and some people more than others. I mean, I know people, students particularly, who had to go back to school and they lost a parent or they lost a grandparent, and we can't negate that. We have to recognize that people have these backstories that they bring, you know, to 2023.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
Anything else you'd like listeners to know about you and your work?
I just want to say that emotions are absolutely so fascinating. They're incredible to study, and studying emotions and aging. Mm-hmm. And I know that for most undergraduates, aging, you know, they think 25 is old. So, people who were born, I mean, this is before the pandemic, but people who were born in 2000s and 2009, for example, could expect in America, 50% of them, they expected to live to be 100. Half.
Wow.
Others say it's about 30%, but still, that's to live to be 100. So people are living longer and healthier lives than ever before.
Right.
Studying emotional well-being, I mean, what's the point of living if you're not happy and thriving and, you know, feeling like you want to be alive?
Yes.
And so the study of emotions is fascinating, and people who are planning their own long, long lives need to take care of their emotional well-being.
You bet. One thing I didn't ask you, and I think Dimitri Zuckerman studied this in his program, is what about the emotions of people with disabilities and chronic illnesses?
Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it's really interesting because what we find, so there's a lot of research looking at, you know, the effects of when something hits you hard, you know, so the effects of divorce, the effects of disability, the effects of chronic illness. And what we find in aging is that that people are generally pretty good at adapting and rebounding and maintaining that healthy quality of life. And the World Health Organization, for example, defines healthy aging not as the absence of chronic disease or the absence of functional disability. They define healthy aging as being able, even with functional disability, if you have it, being able to carry out the activities that make you happy and that keep a person having that high sense of well-being.
Awesome.
So, however, there is research to say that when people have severe chronic disability, then it's then that we do see declines in well-being.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of the theory I developed here, strength and vulnerability.
Okay.
Integration, and that is that there are strengths with aging. There are strengths with our ability to choose environments that are healthy for us and to have that high well-being. But there are also vulnerabilities, and it's physiological vulnerabilities that can make dealing with high levels of arousal very difficult for us.
Yeah.
And more so the older we get and the more likely we are to have chronic illnesses and diseases. And there comes a point when the environment is such that we can't avoid the things that bother us, that we can't make them go away, you know, that sometimes loss of people we love dearly
yes.
and without being able to replace them or significant physical health loss. And then we do see that people experience declines in their well-being.
Sure.
And they're tough. They're tough.
Yeah. Yeah. I always say, you know, just try to take one small step. There's no time frame. People say, oh, you know, you have to get over it. Sometimes we can't get over it, but we can try to take a couple small steps.
Yeah, there are studies looking at people, for example, who lost their spouse, and sometimes you see that they bounce back, but sometimes it takes about 8 years for the mm-hmm. So it takes about 8 years for on average. So it's and some people never do, and some people actually, you know, do pretty quickly, but
yeah.
it varies, obviously.
I do want to mention, we've been talking to Professor Susan Charles, who's right here at University of California, Irvine. On my show blog, which is getthefunkoutshow.kuci.org, I have the link to her faculty website and also her research, the Emotion Research Lab right here at UCI. I want to thank you so much. Is there anywhere else people can find you?
They can look at articles on Google Scholar. So they can put my name in there and search articles there, and they can always send me an email if they're interested.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for calling in. I've really enjoyed this.
All right. Well, thank you.
Have a great day.
Okay. Bye-bye. You too. Bye-bye.
That was Professor Susan Charles chatting with us today, or chatting with me today. Hope you enjoyed this segment. Again, all the information is on the show blog, which is getthefunkoutshow.kuci.org. We're going to take a little break, and then I'll be back. I'm Janine, and you've been listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine.
The opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily represent those of the management of KUCI or the UC Board of Regents. For more information about this show, go to kuci.org.